Case 1 and the record of transmitting the light. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened, and he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. In Kazan's verse, a splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. At the same time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. So yesterday when Kate and Mike finished their talk, the one thought in my mind was, I don't have anything to say about this. I don't have anything more. And I knew that I was supposed to give a talk with David today. But miraculously, overnight, my mind started to fill with thoughts. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. And suddenly, there's too much to talk about. But I wanted to focus on this case and bring in a few other things that support some of the teachings of Kazan in this place. Kazan, who says, praising Shakyamuni Buddha, a splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. That's so beautiful. You can imagine a plum blossom. In another translation, it's an apricot blossom. I'm sure it's some tree that we don't have the equivalent of. And then, at the same time, and note that this translator says, at the same time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. So, if this is perfect and complete enlightenment that Shakyamuni Buddha had, how can there be obstructions? How can there be thorns? And the mind of dualistic thinking says this. Perfect and complete awakening must be free of anything that I don't like. But the teaching of this Mahayana way of ours, the Zen teaching, is that everything, without exception, is the awakened mind, the awakened heart. There are no exceptions. I think I'll say that again. There are no exceptions. That's crazy. How could that be? I know there are exceptions because look at me. I'm such an idiot. Look at me. I just make mistakes all the time. Look at me. Blah, blah, blah. I'm just coming up with a few, but you could fill in more because this is what we human beings do. And we think that if we can just sweep everything away and create some kind of perfect clarity in ourselves, that will be permanent and we'll be all set. As my first teacher used to say, then you can retire and move to Florida. But really, is that what anyone's experience is? Shakyamuni Buddha himself had a really hard time in his life. It sounds really good. He was the Buddha, after all, the awakened one. So cool, light coming off of him and all these other great things. So he didn't even need a nightlight to read from. Really? Is that your experience? When you've had a moment when everything drops away, and I know this is a fact for everyone because this is true for all human beings, in the middle of the endless narrative that we tell ourselves about right and wrong and good and bad, every once in a while, it just drops away. And this dropping away is what we call awakening. Dogen said, body and mind dropped away our body and mind. And his teacher, to affirm him in one of the greatest responses ever, said, body and mind dropped away body and mind. Because like, yeah, what else are you going to say? Whatever you say can't describe it. And yet we do come up with these words and natter on. But that moment when everything drops away, it's like, oh, wood floor. Without even the words, or taste of soup, or, you know, the sunlight coming in the window. It could be so many things. And then immediately the mind comes in with the endless narrative and says, oh great, I had that experience. I can't wait to get to Doksan and tell one of the teachers about it. And I've made it. I can now retire and move to Florida. I hope Jeannie Robom hears this talk. She actually has retired me. But she keeps coming back because the reality is we have to keep coming back. As Kazan says in our wonderful text that we quoted, we said yesterday and today, sort of singing Kazan's words, the waves and the ocean are these two different iterations of the self. And the ocean is the awakened mind with everything clear, the Dharmakaya. But the waves keep forming, because waves keep forming. The self keeps forming. It's the way we are somehow functioning as human beings. And in another place, Kazan said, it's not just human beings. It's everything, everything, everything. And so if it's a problem to be a wave, then what good is being the ocean? In one place in Kazan's commentary, he quotes from the Grassroots Hermitage, which we also chanted today. And he says that ultimately, if you wish to know the undying person in the hut, how could it be something separate from this present skin bag? This is the teaching. How could it be anything but this? How could we keep that little precious moment of clarity safe from harm? Well, we can't, because the safety and the harm are both examples of the awakened heart. There's a lovely little koan. It was one of my first teacher's favorites, and it remains one of my favorites, case 40 in the Blue Cliff Record. Some of you know it. Where a public official who's a Zen student comes to Nanchuan, the great teacher Nanchuan, who was also Zhaozhou's teacher, and says to Nanchuan some quote from an old priest, that everything is one body, everything is just this, isn't that wonderful, the guy says. And Nanchuan doesn't respond to him with words. He just takes him out to the garden and points to a flower and says, people these days see this flower as if they were in a dream. When we talk about awakening, this is what we're talking about. Awakening from the dream of the separate self, or the self that's somehow separate. There's a mind and there's a body. Awakening from the delusion that the parts of ourselves that we don't like are not the awakened parts. And I'm here to tell you, once again, everything is it. So that means that my fear that I felt pulsing through my body before I started talking this morning is an example of the heart of awakening. I don't like it. I used to have a thought that someday I would no longer be afraid when I gave a Dharma talk. When I was younger, I was so afraid when James Ford started having me give talks that I would, I couldn't sleep the night before, and I would always get a migraine, and then I would give a talk. And I don't think anybody knew, except the people I told, because the talk talked itself. And yet my mind kept saying, someday you're going to be free of this. Someday you will be awakened completely and nothing will get in your way. And over the years, what I've discovered is being afraid before giving a talk is not a problem. It's just being afraid before giving a talk. That's it. Whatever happens, maybe a migraine, maybe sleeplessness, maybe shakiness, maybe forgetting what I was going to say and getting lost, that's the talk. Those of us who give Dharma talks, and there are a number of us in this room, know this, that no matter what we plan to say, the talk talks itself. And ultimately, we get to get out of our own way, not through splitting the self into pieces, but through being one body, arising now as fear, now as sadness, now as anger, now as joy, now as clarity, now as compassion, now as happiness. It doesn't matter what form the self takes because it's just waves coming up from this vast ocean. The waves take these forms, and when we actually wake up, we begin to see this truth that Keizan is pointing to, that Nanchuan is pointing to, that all masters of the past and present and hopefully the masters of the future will point to, that this is it. And whenever we make an exception, here's the weird, tricky thing, even making the exception, even being deluded, even thinking someday I will not be nervous anymore, is it too. There are no loopholes, none whatsoever. And the loopholes are it too. Everything is it. If we actually can honor this in our lives, then this is the awakened life. It doesn't look any different from the unawakened life. And yet, there's a little bit of a hair's breadth difference that makes everything, everything different. So no matter what's happening for us, no matter where we get caught, to recognize being caught is happening. Being lost, being confused is happening. Being in the dream of our endless narratives and stories about the way things are, this is it too. And then we wake up and the world is waiting to offer itself to us in the form of that flower of Nanchuan's, in the form of our wildly beating heart, in the form of the stories we get lost in. This is the promise of this practice. And now, to say even more about this matter, I hand it off to David.
Saying more about this matter. Quite a challenge as we head in to this central promise, the promise of liberation. All of us are here because we want something. We are here also because we know something. In the history of Zen, it turns out that the challenges and controversy that have happened in the Boundless Way community this past year or so are not unique. That Zen communities and human beings from the very beginning have argued, have come to disagreements, have come together and split. This matter of waking up, one of the big splits early on in China, the 9th century, Zen is just forming as a movement. Zen is coming together, is being created out of this fertile ground and these teachings from India and China. Some practice groups say, well, awakening is a gradual thing. That although there is insight, we must ever so slowly come and sit again and again. What we're looking for is already here, so there's no need to hurry anywhere. We just sit. And the other monk saying, no, there is delusion. And unless we make our best effort, unless we wholeheartedly give ourselves, we will not realize for ourselves. These monks sing to us from the ghost every night. Do not squander your life. So early on in our school, there is this great debate, sudden versus gradual. We can easily take sides and indeed sometimes need to take sides, need to appear as this perspective or that perspective, need to say no, need to say yes. But the yes and the no are both included. Sudden and gradual are both true. The mind thinks that it lives in a world where there is yes without no. The mind thinks that life is something separate from death. But as we go more deeply into our life, your life, which is the life of all worlds, there is only breathing in and breathing out. There is not some world that you are born into that was there before you and will go on after you. You are born and your whole universe is born with you. And you die and your whole world dies. Each one of us, a universe, each one of us from this perspective, separate. You can want to be like someone else. You can imagine that if only I was more like and fill in the blank. But you cannot, and you cannot even know what it is really like for another human being. I think if we did know what it is like for another human being, we would maybe be glad to be ourselves. Thank goodness. But we imagine life without death, and there is no life without death. And Keizan, in his wonderful verse, seems to be bringing the thorns in, bringing in death. So this great awakening, this great realization, and some of the translations of Buddha's words upon awakening are quite wonderful, and a number of them start, how wonderful, like cool, like, oh my goodness, how wonderful, how wonderful, everything is already awakened. How wonderful, how wonderful, just this. And in those moments, as Melissa said, that we all know, probably biggest danger in Zen is that enlightenment becomes talked about and we begin to think that it is something we don't have. That if we had it, then we would be okay. But awakening does not belong to the Zen school. It does not belong to Buddhism. It is not, does not belong to anyone. It is utterly human and utterly natural. Each one of us has tasted this. And indeed, this taste is beyond compare. Those moments when it is clear and the full moon shines down and you see the moon and the moon sees you. Or you hug your grandchild and your grandchild hugs you. Or you hear the music and the music hears you, whatever it is, for a heartbeat. Maybe a long time, and there are, there indeed are deeper and deeper experiences of this non-separation. And in our practice, important that we strive. It is important that you give yourself to what you love. It is important that you do not believe your teachers, that you do not read the words of the ancestors and say, oh yeah, I guess that's true. But you must find out for yourself. No one else can chew your food. The great Simpsons episode where Homer goes into the old folks' home and he sees someone in a wheelchair and he says, why do I have to walk? That guy's riding in the wheelchair. So he gets his wheelchair. Then he sees someone else on IV and he says, why do I have to chew my food? And so the next scene is him with a bag of potato chips, IV, into his arm. Indeed, you must chew your own food. There is no IV for the Dharma. Right? You must digest your own life. This is terribly difficult. So hard. Nothing harder. And you will be frustrated and discouraged and lost. Utterly lost. And this is why we come together. To support each other, to encourage each other as we little by little die on the cushion. Little by little, everything you have is taken away. We call this the great death. We call this waking up to what has already been here. You do not contain Buddha nature. You are Buddha nature. This awakening is the life that has pumped your heart and breathed your breath and digested your food from the very beginning. So we are here singing praises of this great mystery that is inexplicable, unimaginable, unfabricated. We cannot hold on to it and put it in a box. We cannot hold on to it and take it with us, because we are it. You are it. This moment already accomplished. Here we sit again and again. Not something to believe, but what if it's true? What if this moment, these feelings, these thoughts, these sensations, what if the Buddha was not kidding when he said, how wonderful, how wonderful, everything is already awake. Me and you too. Thank you. So please sit comfortably, turn this way if you'd like. Our Dharma dialogue.
Thank you for your talks. I'm speaking because I might as well make a fool of myself first. So, while you were speaking, what arose for me was this sort of sense, and I've had it since I was a child, that there's sort of like this common view, okay? And it is that we're all individuals. And I say it as a child, because I went to school and it was you're Stephen, and Stephen sits in this chair here. That's your seat. Okay. And this is your name, and this is your name you put on your paper. And Stephen, here are the 10 words that you need to learn how to spell. Okay. And Stephen, you've gotten 8 of them correct and 2 of them wrong. And Sally over here, she's much better than you. She's gotten all 10. And it goes on. It just goes on and on and on. Okay. And yet here we are. And here I hear I am no different than any of the other jokers in this room. Right? That's what I've just heard. No different in a very important way.
What's that important way?
We're all enlightened. Eh? We're all here. We all have the same little every once in a while. I wake up. So, I don't want to say that Zen is like a stripping away. It's not. It's not a stripping away. But it certainly is something. You know what the way I like to envision it? I know it's absolutely incorrect and absolutely wrong to put a name to it. But it's like that old Shakyamuni Buddha. He said, here's your medicine, take your medicine. So that's for me. I come and I take my medicine.
Well, that's a different perspective. So I don't think everybody's the same. You know? I think Sally probably was a better speller. and it is... It is quite a both and kind of thing, because the very particularity, you know, we're not trying to obliterate distinctions here, but even including those distinctions. So what we do share is that each one of us is separate. Each one of us has our own karma, our own life that's playing out, and it's both what is most different about each one of us, and it is what is absolutely unique and common, you know, in the particular form that we can only wake up in the particular form to the particular form, and that's not separate from what is utterly the same. Yeah, thank you.
Probably all of us have struggled with the kind of thing that Steve was talking about in terms of trying to figure out, are we supposed to think that we're all the same? Are we supposed to see ourselves individually? Of course, that back and forth is what it's all about. You think we're one, then you push us over to the other side, right? So we're always wrong. One of the things that James Ford said early on, I'm not sure if I won't quote him correctly, but it's been very helpful to me, was he says something like, we're all broken, but our work is to find ourselves in the other person and the other person in us. Which is sort of a way of thinking about the difference and the similarity at the same time. And I'm appreciative that you mentioned what's been happening to Van Wisswe. I don't know how much it's been on other people's minds, but it's been very much on my mind. And I have been really struggling to find myself in these other people who I don't understand right now and I'm mad at. So, and to think at the same time that maybe we are also part of who that group is, and we are all going to be same and different. And I don't know how, but really, that's a real life moment-to-moment struggle that I'm going through right now, with trying to define myself in them, or to be able to identify with some of what
Well, and it just feels so human. You know, I think about, you know, the election, Right, I've been trying to see myself in Trump supporters for a really, sorry if any of you are Trump supporters, come to me in Doksan, we can talk about our differences and help us see each other. But there really are different opinions, different narratives, different views, different stories. And our friends in the UK are struggling with Brexit in the same way. And, you know, if you look back through the history of the world, everybody does this. There's some disruption in every organization, every country, every group. And the wall goes up, and it's so strong. And we harbor ill will. That's one of the things that that human beings do. And sometimes we kill each other because the ill will is so strong, right? So this anything that happens to us, the stuff in Boundless Way or the election or anything we encounter at work, you know, there are actually two other very big Buddhist communities going through some similar rupture right now. You know, that this is what human beings do with each other. We form the monks of the Eastern and Western Hall, you know, in that famous story about Nanchuan again. Nanchuan, who said people these days see this flower as though they're in a dream. He also cut a cat in two to demonstrate how awful it is to do this. And most of it is done internally. You know, we're having these raging arguments in our own hearts and minds. So I keep thinking about my first teacher who I left because, you know, that group also fell apart because he was screwing around with his students. Literally. he used to say, he had a lot of wisdom also. You know, it's not black and white. And he used to say, everyone is unique, but no one is special. So you might say they're unique viewpoints, but there's not the special viewpoint, you know. I got it figured out. This is it. So this is really an opportunity for practice. Everything is like this.
And when you talk, it makes me think that I've actually identified the problem with the world, and it's those other people.
Right? Who reside within you.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what Melissa was saying in her talk. Of course, you know, where is the other one, right? And both, you know, separate and the same. And the other thing, yeah. So it is a koan, and there is, I think, some real disillusionment. Because we'd like to think that if you sit on the cushion long enough or your insight is deep enough, that you will be different. Or maybe that I will be different. And I guess the good news and bad news is human. Right? And the real teachers we need to look to are the teachers in our heart. And people can guide us and lead us, but this chewing your own food, you know, this, there is not an expert in your life who will, there are many people who will tell you what to do, and most of them you shouldn't listen to at all. But to discover for yourself, what's my path? What is it that I need to do? I think it was Dietrich Bonhoeffer said the beginning, disillusionment is the beginning of true community. You know, when we see that the other person, the other people aren't who we think, and then we see, well, I'm not who I think I was. But it is certainly our koan to all of us work with this. Yeah, thank you.
So I was struck by the as Carolyn was speaking and then in your response, I was struck by the power of those pronouns, we and they, you know, and they're really just, I mean, they're these empty shifters. You know, if you're sitting with the monks of the North Hall, then the monks of the North Hall are we, and if you are sitting with the monks of the South Hall, the monks of the North Hall are they. And that's, you know, and it's the same with the I and the you, you know, it's just these empty you know, linguistically famously empty, but they're so strong, you know. And I was, and I was with a lot of what Carolyn was saying, and I was also surprised, you know, that a year ago we were all we, and now there's a we and a they, and I'm trying really hard to maintain that sense of we-ness while acknowledging the emergent they-ness, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And plus what you added so importantly, David, that all the they's are always I. I'm sorry, but this is sounding a little bit like, you know, Lewis Carroll, but this is how I
sounds
feel.
Sounds a little like Duncan.
And if I could just add something about the Trump supporters, you know, The day after that happened, all these pundits that couldn't possibly have seen it coming all knew why it did. and one person pointed out that you could walk down this line of counties from Maine to Georgia, and with the exception of one part of Connecticut, every county would be a county that voted for Trump. And I said, yeah, that's the Appalachian Trail corridor that I spent 11 years walking. And all those people I met, you know, all the locals I met were we, you know, and they were nice to me. Mm-hmm. They help me.
Yeah. Well, that's the bottom line, really. You know, as we were talking about this, I tried to remember what it says in the precept about not harboring ill will, and it directly is about what you're saying, Alan. Bodhidharma says, in the realm of the selfless Dharma, not contriving reality for the self, is called the precept of not harboring ill will. You know, this is what we do, to make a me and a you, an us and a them. We have to contrive, it's a contriving, a reality for the separation. And it really is like the waves in the ocean going, I'm separate from the ocean. You know, that we-ness that you experienced on the trail. That's something underneath all this that I think ultimately does arise in these situations.
Cindy.
I think, wanting that IV of potato chips. But I think it's really hard to sit here and agree to disagree and agree to disagree in my own head and my own heart.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Deep bow, Cindy.
Before I came here, I had to write a paper for school, and it was called How Do You Know Who You Are? You'd think it was like a Buddhist class or something, you know. I remember reading the syllabus, and it was for a human behavior class for social work. And so I really sat with it. And a lot of what they were pointing to was, talking about roles of gender, roles of race, roles of ways that we do identify ourselves, or are identified without any choice. And so I ended up, you know, going back and forth between it, kind of getting very into nothing specific and then acknowledging the specifics of it. But I titled it The Thin Line Between Divisive Identification and Dismissive Non-Duality. And so what I really found in it is that, you know, it is all included, it's both, but that that the non-duality, you know, that's really what I wanted to write about, you know, that I really feel like we're all one, and in that it dismisses the whole reality of what's really, really happening. And in social work, you have to acknowledge what's really there too, or else you can't really work with any of it. You know, you're like so far away from truly any problem that what can you really help, you know? And so I still, like, you know, am sitting with it. And I did kind of end with the acknowledgement of the identification is something that you're privileged to have sometimes, because people, not everyone gets to identify themselves. Sometimes you are identified into a category without any, without the privilege of saying yes or no to it, and that things then are done to you based on that. And so, you know, I'm sure my teacher is maybe reading it right now thinking, you know, what's really going on here, but it just was, it just was quite a paper to write. Mm. And it was really quite a great paper to write and then come here.
You know, there are these, it's the way the mind works, that's what we're studying. And so often it works in dualities in that co-create each other and are part of the definition of one is the definition of the other. And so we do this constantly. And it's actually not inherently bad. And I think that a lot of times when we think of Zen, we imagine we're gonna get rid of that function and rise above it somehow. And we don't. What we do is we see how it operates. And we see its ephemerality, its fluidity, its dependence, and in some way that makes it less absolute, which is emptiness. In a sense, it's not that emptiness is something separate. It is the formations that are arising. And so we're practicing with those right now in our Sangha. It's very powerful and very emotional and very hard for many, many, many of us. So to really honor that and respect that, that we are all going through this kind of same thing together. You know, we, meaning the inclusive we, the two sides, the East and West halls, going through this together. Mm. We're all sharing in this.
I keep coming back to the waves and ocean. Mm. I'm thinking images, so this one explains to me the situation or illuminates it. And I think about the times that I've spent on the ocean or in the ocean, and there's the surface waves, right? And it's important to know what's the characteristic of the wave. It's one thing to take your boat or your surfboard or whatever onto a 5-foot wave, and quite another thing for a 30-foot wave. Mm-hmm. There is a real difference, and those differences matter. Mm-hmm. And there's also a way to plunge down under the waves and recognize that they all arise out of this base, right? That where there is no turbulence and there is no differentiation. And to say that one is true and the other isn't is to miss it and to put yourself into a dangerous position. Being able to recognize the sameness and yet know the importance of the differences and that they really matter, that there's something distinct going on. So not to get stuck in either one. Which I do all the time. Both in the ocean and
here. As we might say, get in line.
Well, and it also brings me back to Larry Yang's book, Larry, who came to visit us and talk about diversity in the Dharma, and talking about how important it is to honor the particularity of people's experience when they come. And just because I walk into a room and feel that it's safe doesn't mean that the room is safe. It means that for me, and so honoring both sameness and difference, you know, we can miss it on either side. Yeah, Kevin.
I don't know why I can't seem to resist the wave metaphors. My first retreat, I had what I think is actually a very similar reaction, which is it's all well and good to talk about, you know, waves not being separate from ocean. But I'm sort of thinking about actually in separation from land, and the waves are caused by the butting up of the ocean with the land. And that, you know, if the waves are small, it's a gentle sort of caress and you can ride it and it's great. But if there's force behind it, then that collision can be really scary and harmful and deadly. So, I sort of feel this talking about the waves, and it feels like happy and nice, but the had very terrible encounters with waves as well. So,
yeah.
Well, and you're pointing to something that Mike and I were talking about the other day, that conflict is not necessarily a bad thing, you know, but it needs to, I think it's a problematic thing if it's ignored, right? So there is something that's, we create conflict in Zen by asking you to sit still for 25 minutes without moving. The body rebels against that, and in that rebellion, in that the water hitting the cliff, there's some alertness that starts happening. That's what wakes us up. It's not just la la la, let's all sit around and do whatever we want. There really are guidelines for behavior in a retreat, and also in Zen in general, the precepts. And we collide with them all the time. And that's not a problem. You know, I think people come to spiritual practices looking for everything to be nice. And I know that I've had that problem in the past when there's been conflict of just trying to make it go away somehow, trying to resolve it. And it's another reason why I love the koan about Nanchuan and the cat, because he doesn't try to fix the problem by saying, let's all sit down and we'll find our commonality. He holds up a cat and says, if you don't get it together, you guys, I'm going to kill this cat. And we didn't, that story appears in a few koan collections, because I think it's pointing to something really rich about what it means to be human. People love being at war. You know, people love getting angry. There's some people who just like thrive on it. And there are people who hide from it and avoid it. And I feel like for us too, ocean, wave, shore, ocean, these apparent opposites need to find a way to interact with each other. I think they both arise. And of course in the second part of that koan, Jiaozhou demonstrates that. If you haven't done this koan yet, I hope I haven't spoiled it for you.
So I was sort of bracing myself to come here because, you know, I always come to a half to, and I just, you know, had sort of only been hearing on the periphery about things that are going on, and it's been sort of worrying me. But I always come. But I just reminded myself that when I think about who I am as a self, it's just a whole bunch of individual experiences that I've had, some of those with other people and some of them not. And everybody's self, whatever that is, I know that's just an artificial thing, but that thing that I'm describing is their own combination of things, which is also unique. And that at any moment when we're in community, we're shaping the community by what we bring to it and what's happening, and it's shaping us. And it's this one more thing that makes us who we are. We're building skills, we're building awareness, and sometimes things happen that we're not ready for and we're not brave enough to do. And I remember when I was younger and living in the city in the south side of Chicago, places I couldn't go, places where I'd have to run. And some people would say, I'm just going to be brave. And, you know, I'm thinking like, so sometimes brave is not a wise thing. You know, if you're a missionary and you go to a place where they kill you if you show up on their island, that might not be the bravest thing to do. So I think that sort of like, what am I capable of doing? What am I ready to do? What am I trying to do? So I figured, okay, the reason that I come to Rahatsu is experiencing and sharing the Dharma and being fortified to go out and do that. I've done a lot of work in congregations before this, a lot, and some of them in conflict and many of them in transition. And there are times when people say, this is changing too much. It's not what I want to be the old way. I don't want change. I'm not ready. And then there's other people that say, we're stuck in old ways. If we don't change this, we can't live into our mission. And, you know, watching people grapple with that, knowing that some people leave. And, you know, when I look around, this room, and I think about who I've sat with here and at Allison's Orchard, mm-hmm. and it's an exit house. There's a lot of ghosts in the room, and many of them have left for you know, perfectly good reasons. They moved away, and then there's other people that just couldn't be here anymore, and they just have sort of found other places, but some of them I know are in other communities working to further the Dharma, and that warms my heart.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what saves me.
Yeah. Oh, beautifully said. And I would say even the people who left who aren't directly doing Dharma work, they're directly doing Dharma work.
Right, because their self is informed by everything that they've done here. So everything that we do here is helping to empower us to...
That's right. You know, wow, that's beautiful. And I think that's a wonderful note to end on.
Yeah.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, everybody.